Everyone, welcome back. So on March 5th, 2013, Michael Moore tweeted this. He said, Hugo Chavez declared the oil belonged to the people. He used the oil money to eliminate 75% of extreme poverty and to provide free health care and education for all. And of course, Michael Moore has a net worth of $50 million. He lives in a 10,000 square foot mansion. And he also denies he's part of the 1%. So today we're going to smash the myth that Venezuela isn't a socialist country with my good friend Jose Nino. Jose is a writer for Mises.org and AMMO.com, and I'll be linking to a ton of his work in the show notes, but he's especially knowledgeable on Venezuela considering he was born there. So, Jose, thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure to be here, Stephen.
You know, a funny story before we begin our discussion. It must have been last April or May. I was getting really interested in Venezuela. I'd known about the problems there, but I had no idea to what extent it was occurring. And I found this one article on Mises.org. Like I said, probably last April or May. And I went through that one article and I had so much information out of it. I got so much information out of it that I was able to do a whole episode on it. Fast forward to last July, we were both at Mises University, me and you both. And I think we were talking at Chipotle and you at one point mentioned, like, by the way, my name's Jose Nino. Like, Jose Nino? That's the guy that wrote the article I sourced that one time. So I don't know, it's just kind of a small world.
No, indeed it is. And I kind of felt humbled that I'm starting to get somewhat of a following. I never thought that I would be like getting cited or even mentioned in a lot of these circles because of that.
Yeah, totally funny. Totally funny story. But Jose, maybe you could start off by telling the viewers a little bit about yourself. You were actually born in Venezuela, so I'm guessing this hits close to home for you.
Yes, I was born in Venezuela. But I came to the United States when I was relatively young, around 7 years old, right before Hugo Chavez got into power. But from that point forward, I progressively became more interested in politics, especially with what was going on in Venezuela after Hugo Chavez was in office and everything like that. And also just following U.S. politics, like the Iraq War and other events like that, like 9/11. And in 2007, I saw some YouTube videos of Ron Paul, and I just was hooked to his message. I really bought into the idea of libertarianism. And I was heavily involved with a lot of student groups at the University of Texas at Austin. From there, I got involved with other national groups. And now, these days, I do a lot of writing gigs, as you mentioned, for Mises and Ammo.com. I do political consulting work on the side. I'm still very much in the liberty movement. And I do write about Venezuela, not as much as before, but I do answer people's questions and give people a libertarian perspective of what's going on there and show how it's actually the poster boy of the modern day failures of socialism.
Yeah, we're going to get into that later, but one claim you often hear is that, well, Venezuela is not socialist, they nationalized oil. And it's like, well, that's state control of, you know, we'll get into that. So I guess to start here, I just want to give a few background facts about Venezuela, and I'm going to let you do most of the talking in the episode. But just so people know, Venezuela, it's slightly larger than the state of Texas as a country. They have a population of over 32 million people. Now, the area itself contains the largest amount of proven crude oil reserves in the world. They have over 302 billion barrels of oil worth. And for some perspective, the United States, which is over 10 times larger than Venezuela, has 9 times less proven reserves than Venezuela. Even Saudi Arabia, who is well known for their oil supply, ranks second, and they have 13.5% less proven reserves. So by all means, they're a very resource-rich country, but they have some of the poorest people on the planet right now. So maybe you could start us off, and I know the story of Venezuela's success, because they were very successful initially, began in 1914, and maybe even if you have some background information about pre-1914, that would help too, but start us off.
Well, Venezuela gained its independence in the early 1820s from Spain, and from the 1820s to 1914, it was a regional backwater. It was actually one of the region's poorest countries. In fact, Venezuela used to export coffee, but even its coffee could not compare to its neighbor Colombia in terms of quality and was always beaten out in the market. And as a result, Venezuela was quite poor and very politically unstable. Governments during that time period featured lots of turmoil, coups, and even there was a civil war as well in that time frame. But 1914 was especially interesting year because that was when the Venezuelan government actually discovered some massive oil reserves, and they were able to lease them out to foreign companies and also domestic companies as well. And from that point forward, Venezuela went from regional backwater to boom country in a matter of decades. But a lot of people will say, oh, it's just the oil. But there were a lot of other factors in play. Venezuela had a very limited government at that time. There was not many regulations. Taxes were low. And curiously, Venezuela was late to the central banking party. Its central bank was not established until 1939. So it had a sound money tradition. Also, what helped it was that it was not affected directly by the World War II carnage. And in fact, it attracted a lot of immigrants from countries afflicted by World War II, like Italy, also attracted a lot of skilled immigrants from Spain, Portugal, and even its neighbor Colombia. And through those factors, Venezuela became not only the richest country in Latin America by the 1950s, but it was as rich as many European countries. Some reports contend that it was in the top 10 richest countries on a per capita GDP basis.
From what I understand, they had the fourth highest GDP in the world in the 50s. I mean, it just sounds unbelievable if you're only researching what's happening today.
Yes, indeed. And it showed that Venezuela was actually very prosperous, and its growth was no coincidence. It wasn't just resources, because there's a lot of oil-based countries that are blessed with that, but they never have exploited it well and never became that rich.
So I guess Ramilio Betancourt, he was kind of the first guy that really started taking the country down a horrid path. He was a social democrat. I think he was an ex-Marxist. Tax rates tripled to 36% under him. What else can you tell me about Betancourt?
Well, Romulo Betancourt is an interesting leader. This, just to give some context to your listeners, Romulo Betancourt was the first president when Venezuela returned to democracy from 1914 it was from 1908 until 1958. The country was predominantly ruled by military governments, though the military governments were actually quite hands-off when it came to the economy, but they were pretty repressive, so they got a lot of backlash from a lot of the radical left, and among the radical left was Romulo Betancourt. He was actually exiled because he was a member of the Communist Party and was involved in a lot of activist activities, and also was declared a subversive, so he was exiled by the Venezuelan government. When he came back, he moderated his views a lot. He was a social democrat, so he still believed in a pretty expansive state. And in fact, he actually believed in communist ends, but not in their means, insofar as that he was not advocating for like a violent overthrow of the bourgeoisie or using like Marxist guerrilla warfare to achieve his vision. Nevertheless, whenever he became the first president of Venezuela in the early 1960s, his government initiated a series of troubling reforms, such as land regulation that undermined property rights and created the basis of Venezuela's slums known as ranchos. He also, like you mentioned, pulled the income tax. He actually devalued the Bolivar a slight bit, and as well as laying the basis for the eventual nationalization of the petroleum industry as well.
Right, because from what I understand, he wanted to nationalize a whole bunch of industries. He just really didn't get the chance. Now, fast forward to 1975, Carlos Perez, Betancourt got his wish with Perez.
Yes, Carlos Andrés Pérez was the most groundbreaking period of Venezuela's democratic history because it fundamentally altered the nature of governance in Venezuela. Because once he nationalized the oil industry, the government now had a piggy bank they could use from petroleum revenue to finance whatever the politicians' hearts desired, whether it be lavish infrastructure projects, welfare programs, crony subsidies, you name it, that system enabled it, the nationalization of the petroleum industry. And not only that, they nationalized the iron industry and they partially nationalized the central bank, which was already quite politicized, but now the Venezuelan government had a majority stake in the central bank. So anytime the Venezuelan government had like fiscal problems, they would just turn to the central bank for inflating the currency and continue the profligate spending and welfare bonanza.
Yeah, and back to your original point that they didn't realize what central banking could do for the government till later on. I mean, that's probably one factor in why they were so successful is that they didn't have this infinite amount of money to print. Again, fast forward to 1983, Venezuela experienced what they called Black Friday. Now, this wasn't a shopping day, by the way. The bolivar was beginning to devalue very quickly. So, what happened in the 80s?
The 1980s were essentially a lost decade for Venezuela. After the massive spending binges of the 1970s and the overall status environment that was created there, the Venezuelan economy just became stagnant. Oil prices plummeted as well, so that didn't help.
You know, maybe we should have mentioned the energy crisis in the 70s, because I imagine that affected them.
Yes, the energy crisis in the 70s is what spurred the nationalization because a lot of Venezuelan technocrats believe that these prices would always remain this high. Thus, we must nationalize oil so we could pay for everything. Like the oil revenues would pay for everything, and we wouldn't have to worry about using taxes or other means or making the economy more competitive. But 1980s, a lot of the chickens came home to roost after oil prices collapsed, and the Venezuelan political economy became very stagnant. And as you mentioned, the bolivar was devalued, which was once the strongest currency in all of Latin America, now was on the ropes. And interestingly, here's a fun fact: Venezuelans have witnessed double-digit inflation every year since 1985 in one shape or form. Monetary policy in the 1980s for Venezuela changed dramatically. The country basically became inflation burden from that point forward, or even debt burden as well, and poorer as a result too. And a lot of unrest emerged from that. And by the time the late 1980s arrived, a lot of people were very worried about the state of the country, and political instability started to become a feature of Venezuela, which was almost unheard of in decades prior.
Now, 1999 is when Chavez came into power. The bolivar, I think, by that point, had already been devalued over 12,000% or 752% a year. I could give a few facts about Chavez, but maybe you could give some background on Hugo Chavez.
Well, first of all, Carlos Andrés Pérez ironically came back into the scene in the late 1980s and 90s as president. And the reason I mentioned him is that his second administration was very controversial. He campaigned as like a welfare socialist promising a return to the bonanza of the 1970s. But when he came into office, he realized that in shambles, it was uncompetitive, debt burden, and just fiscally out of control. So he had to turn to the IMF. And the IMF proposed a series of decent reforms for privatization, cutting tariffs and subsidies. Unfortunately, they proposed some stuff like the introduction of a value-added tax and
What is
they
that?
never even it's kind of like a sales tax of sorts. It's a national sales tax, and but they never really struck at the core of the problem, which was like the nationalization of the oil industry. And Pérez was actually able to pass some of these reforms, and it looked like Venezuela would have some breathing room, but political instability emerged because his party, Acción Democrática, Democratic Action in English, was completely opposed to these reforms. They were hardcore socialists, and in fact, they were fomenting unrest on the streets, and it resulted in an infamous crackdown called the Caracazo in 1989 that resulted in like the deaths of 100 people. But then in 1992, things really got heated when an upstart lieutenant colonel by the name of Hugo Chavez launched two unsuccessful coups against Pérez's government. While they were unsuccessful and Chavez got imprisoned, they sent a very strong message to the entire political class that there was a huge swath of the population that was just pissed off with the corruption and essentially completely discredited the political system, because Pérez would be impeached a year later, and Venezuela's bipartisan political order, for the listeners that don't know, Venezuela from 1958 to 1998 was governed by two major parties, Democratic Action and the Christian Democrats. Well, by the time Chavez's coups were over, that two-party system was in shambles. People were very hostile towards it and did not trust it anymore. But Chavez eventually got pardoned too by one of Pérez's successors, and with the political climate in disarray and a huge segment of the population completely distrustful of the political class, Chavez had an easy base to tap into. And when he started campaigning across the country and threw his hat in the presidential ring, it was a wrap, because he had a huge amount of the country, especially in the urban areas and the shanty towns, behind him. And he was on a rendezvous with destiny. He crushed his elections in 1998 and came to power with a very strong mandate.
I mean, did it eventually get to the point where it's kind of an election, but it's more or less like an election with one or two people on the ballot and everybody already knows who's going to win?
Yeah, he had opposition. This was like when Venezuela's institutions were still relatively stable. But everybody knew Chavez was going to win because the country was poor. Actually, this is another very scary fact. In 1998, the average Venezuelan was poorer than the average Venezuelan in 1958 on a per capita GDP basis. It was one of the few countries in Latin America that actually became poorer in that time period. The only other country that suffered a similar trend was Nicaragua, but this was a country that suffered a civil war and a totalitarian socialist regime. So Venezuela's conflict was completely homegrown and the result of multiple decades of socialist-like policies and just destroying the capital base of the country.
Right. And between 2004 to 2015, they made about $750 billion in oil, and this accounted for like 96% of their foreign earnings. But by 2012, their budget deficit reached 15.6% of their GDP. And another fact I can throw out here is between 1999 and 2014, they spent $718 billion in social welfare programs. So they spent almost all this money they made on social welfare programs. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the things Chavez implemented, like universal health care and everything else he tried to do.
Yeah, Chavez, he had the benefit of some of the highest oil prices in history. And the funny thing is, the Venezuelan political economy stayed the same. The oil industry was still nationalized for the most part. There were some privatizations in the 1990s, but they didn't really go far enough in liberalizing it. But Chavez doubled down completely on the failed policies of the 1958 to 1998 period, but he added a tyrannical twist to it. He expropriated private property without compensation, passed a series of exchange controls, completely nationalized the state-owned oil company Petróleos de Venezuela, and put all his cronies in there and used the money from the petroleum revenues to spend it on vote buying programs to consolidate his political support. These were just welfare programs. There was no wealth being created. And the oil boom economy was just like a fake type of economy where you saw some decent numbers in the macro sense. But when you looked at the underlying Venezuelan economy, it was built on a house of cards, and it was only a matter of time before it would collapse. And even during Chavez's regime, with the booming oil prices, there were consumer shortages starting to emerge as early as 2007, because he started passing a series of price controls and all of that, and it continued to the interventions continued to build up. And once Chavez died, the so-called Venezuelan miracle was already on the ropes and about to go on the way out.
You know, one thing, interesting thing I want to point out is the misery index. Now, this was devised by Arthur Okun. And by the way, for you economic nerds out there, if you're familiar with, for example, Okun's law, same guy. But Venezuela has been number one in the misery index for at least a few years now. And what the misery index tries to show is when you add the seasonal unemployment plus the annual inflation rate. Let me just read some numbers here so you really get an idea of how crazy this is. So ranked number 10th is Saudi Arabia. Their misery value is 15.4. Argentina is number 3. They're at 27.1. South Africa is number 2 at 33.1. Now, Venezuela, their keep in mind, I just said South Africa is at 33.1. Venezuela is at 1,872. That's what they are in the misery index. I mean, that just sounds unfathomable.
Yes, that's the product of the really terrible price control policies and exchange controls, as well as the overly politicized Venezuelan central bank that basically turned the Bolivar into monopoly money. And that's now you see these widespread shortages where people have to wait in really long lines to get basic goods like toilet paper, flour, sugar, you name it. And even manufacturing activities like the automobile industry in Venezuela have completely collapsed because there's just such a lack of dollars, and the investment climate is so unpredictable that foreign investors and capital are just giving the country the cold shoulder.
Jeez. Are you aware of Professor Steve Hanke? I think that's how his name's pronounced.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, because back when I was doing research on this initially, the inflation rate was over 16,000% and prices were doubling every 17.5 days. But as recently as this last September, Steve Hanke put out some info that showed it's over 45,000% a year. Just totally insane. So here's my next question. How do you respond to the claim that it's not a socialist country? I mean, based on what people have heard, I hope you kind of get the gist, but how do you respond to that? Because like I said, some say they nationalize oil, so it's really just capitalism's fault. Some blame the sanctions, which maybe the sanctions do have a part to play in it, but to what extent?
Well, I'm opposed to like any of these sanctions and whatnot because they actually politically consolidate the socialist government support. They can just say, oh, look at these imperialist Yankees trying to mess with our economy and everything like that. But when you look at Venezuela, it's absolutely a socialist country. the destruction of private property through expropriations is like a fixture of socialism. It's in the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. And the Venezuelan government controls the education system, another pillar of it. Venezuelan government controls telecommunications and media, which is another pillar. They've got price controls, which are some of the largest violations of basic economics, because without a functioning price system, an economy will not be able to operate in the proper manner. And as a result of those price controls, you get massive shortages. And the government is very authoritarian. There is no free speech. You could get jailed for being a dissenter. And yeah, the oil nationalization as well, because that's such a huge feature of a lot of these socialist regimes, that they like to capture industries that feature a lot of foreign investment or even control by foreign companies. So I would say that Venezuela checks out when you look at the Communist Manifesto's characteristics of what a communist economy would look like. It checks out. And I even have an article where for Mises where I talk about how John Oliver is completely wrong about
most things. He's wrong about most things.
He is wrong on a lot of things. Where I mentioned in like a 10-step breakdown how this economy is absolutely socialist. If you haven't,
I guess what I'm interested in is what are people that are actually living there thinking, not the government, just the citizens, like what's in the heart and the minds of the citizens? Do they think it's socialist?
The problem is that a lot of people in Venezuela, and this is based on my experience, they know it's a corrupt government. They can feel it. They can see it through the shortages, through the inflated currency and whatnot. But a good portion of the population doesn't think it's actually socialism. They think it's just corruption. There are pretty woke people, if you will, that know that it's socialism. They've studied economics. They've studied philosophy. They've studied political systems, and they know for a fact that Venezuela is a very socialist economy. And as a result, they've become very good messengers on why this country has become so poor. But unfortunately, in the Western media, you see a lot of people say that, oh, it was just a matter of mismanagement or low oil prices and stuff like that. That's tip of the iceberg at best. And yes, there is corruption and mismanagement, but guess what? That's a feature of socialism. That's not exactly like the cause of it. It's just confusing symptoms with the underlying disease.
Well, you heard it. It's definitely socialist. Now, you did mention the Communist Manifesto. A lot of planks in the there's 10 planks at the end of Section 2 of the Communist Manifesto. I urge everybody to read it, but one of them is Plank 7. It says, extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state. Now, like I said, when I originally started researching this, it was right after, I'm sure you remember, Venezuela, Kellogg's wanted to pull out because I guess they weren't profitable. And Maduro said, not quite. Let's see, I have the quote here. He said, I've taken the decision to deliver the company to the workers in order that they can continue producing for the people. And my question would be, what does that even mean? These people are starving. They're desperate people. I doubt they have any management experience. When he says they're going to give the workers the means of production, does that mean the state's going to own everything? Does that mean they're just going to hand it over to the workers and say, all right, you know, keep the Frosted Flakes coming or whatever? It just sounds bizarre.
Well, the Venezuelan government will have like sympathizers of the regime take over these abandoned factories or these foreign-owned companies and just run it to the ground. And eventually the government takes it over through the military or some other law enforcement or quasi-military bureaucratic agency. And that's been the case on repeated occasions in Venezuela. That's what, and really, this goes to show that even in these like so-called utopian anarcho-syndicalist or even communist movements, that if they want to take over private property and like confiscate it and expropriate it, you're going to have a state apparatus, because it's going to fall apart. And to conduct that, you will have to suppress people. You will have to use the barrel of the gun that is the state to do that. So they claim it's worker owned, but really it turns out to be state owned in the long term.
I mean, I pretty much figured that. You know, there's a lot of parallels in history here. I recently did a lot of research for a history paper, and I was studying the interwar period between World War I and World War II, and I was studying Russia. And basically what happened is, right after the October Revolution, Lenin came into power, and they passed a decree saying the workers will now own the means of production. Well, reading through the Black Book of Communism, which is a great source, there's some stories in there that just talk about how, the worker would go check the safe. And the safe would just be empty because, you know, tragedy of the commons, when you're allowed to take as much as you want when you need it, well, they ran out of stuff all the time. And within a year or two, I think it was within a few years, Lenin had to reverse all his policies because they failed so drastically. And when you hear things like, well, you know, Russia was, they really just had state capitalism. Well, that was because initially they tried to go straight to communism. And Lenin actually admits this in a quote, saying, you know, in 1918, we tried to go straight to communism. You know, it didn't work right away. But, you know, they eventually initiated a new economic policy, which basically allowed some privatization, right? But there's so many parallels in history. And the saddest thing about history is it seems like nobody ever learns from it. So I'm curious if you could give us some insights into the recent announcement that Maduro is injecting billions of euros into the economy. What's that all about? Is that a political move or what?
I'm not too familiar actually with that move, but it does kind of make sense when you think about it, because Venezuelan capital is pretty much destroyed. So it's going to have to rely on foreign money and capital to just stay afloat. In fact, the Venezuelan economy is somewhat dollarized now because of how bad the Bolivar has been debased. People just do not trust it even in the slightest bit. So they're going to turn to a more stable currency like the dollar. Heck, they'll even turn, some Venezuelans will turn to cryptocurrencies because they simply have more value and are more stable than Bolivar.
Yeah, that was actually my next question, is that a lot of Venezuelans are now buying Bitcoin because, you know, obviously last year Bitcoin is very volatile, but it's been holding at like 6,500 for many, many months now. I mean, pretty much solved the volatility problem, at least for now. But yeah, a lot of Venezuelans are holding that now because it's one of the only things holding value. I've also seen pictures, and just imagine you have like a big mound of cash on the table next to it's $1, and it's showing the equivalence of one US dollar. It just reminds me of the hyperinflation in Nazi Germany and Hungary and all those different places when they had hyperinflation. Just hard to imagine carrying that much cash around. That's actually a huge burden.
Yes, it absolutely is. In fact, criminals in Venezuela actually don't even rob you for your money anymore. They rob you for your durable goods or whatever you have on, because the money is practically worthless.
Wow.
And as a result, like, people will have to turn to other money, because hyperinflationary cases always end like that. Either the current hyperinflated currency has to go through like a contraction phase through central banking policy, or that country ends up adopting like a foreign currency, and in the 21st century case, Bitcoin might be that option for countries like Venezuela, because it provides a censorship resistant currency, like as well as a stable store of value. And if you look at Bitcoin's overall monetary policy, it is only limited to the creation of 21 million Bitcoin. So it's fixed in terms of its money supply. And that's a complete contrast from the Bolivar, which can be inflated at whatever the central bank's desire is. And with how, like I mentioned, the state practically owning the central bank, its policy is based on politics, not sound economics.
I mean, whether people are ranting against the gold standard or they're against cryptocurrency, it's always because of the vital fact that it keeps governments in check. It keeps them from going to war. It keeps them from doing all these things that if you can't print up the money, you don't have the money. I mean, that's kind of how the citizens have to live in any country. If you don't have the money, you can't just print it. I guess let's fast forward a little bit to today, or at least in the past few years. I remember in 2015, there was a Venezuelan governor telling people to eat fried rocks. I mean, people were making mud pies. In 2016, a guy named Robert Sanchez said this about the country. We have no food. They're cutting power 4 hours a day, which that sounds crazy. That's what they do in Gaza. Crime is soaring. And President Maduro blames everyone but himself for the mess we find ourselves in. We can't go on like this forever. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Maduro, because we've mostly talked about everyone prior to that.
Well, Maduro has continued all of Chavez's policies. He actually, I would say one thing that's different from Chavez is that he really doubled down on price controls. And a lot of the price controls that he passed are the reason why the shortage crisis in Venezuela is on another level. It's insane. There are talks, as you mentioned, like Lenin's NEP, that the Maduro government might actually have to pass some pseudo-liberalization and free market reforms at the margins just to even stay afloat, because these programs eventually fail. And when they fail, you either double down and basically lead the country down to a path of complete social destruction and potential civil war, or the governments get slightly pragmatic and maintain the same authoritarian structure, but they introduce some reforms so that the country can actually like stay somewhat afloat. But I think what's going to end up happening is like he's going to do some liberalizations here and there, or some of the exchange controls and some of the price controls, but the authoritarian system's going to remain in place. The Venezuelan government will still probably have extraordinary powers in expropriating property, and it's going to continue the same until his government is ousted internally, or people they call an election or some type of protest that peacefully removes him from power.
Yeah, and another point I can add here is, you know, related to Lenin again, whether it was the new economic policy or war communism, it was all used as an excuse. So when they're looking back in history, it's like, oh, well, we had state capitalism, that's why we failed. Well, I mean, your communist policies failed. And a war communism was basically an excuse that, you know, you got to do certain things during war. You got to spend some money. So that's why we're having problems right now. Just totally insane. One of the craziest things I heard is that zoo animals are being stolen. And we're not talking about like parakeets or something like that. They're missing like buffaloes. And there was this one video where you kind of mentioned this earlier. There was a guy, he did an experiment, and he went out and he wanted to see how long would it take for me to get like 8 essential items. He spent the whole day doing it. And I'll link to this video, by the way. And he got 3 by the end of the day. I can't imagine how that actually affects people's lives, because, you know, our America's headed towards socialism, no doubt, but most of us can't even imagine what it's like to walk in a store, not be able to get what you need, not be able to do it in a few minutes. Whereas taking a whole day just to get some eggs and some paper towels and stuff like that, it's just unfathomable for people like us who live in a country like this.
Yes, that's all tied into the price control shortage crisis Venezuela has been going through. And to add on to this, you'll hear stories from Venezuelans that stray dogs on the street are just disappearing, and Lord knows what they're being used for. Very likely for food, because people just can't find food. People are literally eating zoo animals, as you mentioned, and stealing them. And that's what happens when you have a socialistic economy. And that's the thing too. Socialism is far from humane. It's inhumane. It's terrible for the people. It's terrible for animals that are traditionally used as pets. And it's corrosive on all fronts. And a lot of people like to see economy as just fancy graphs and statistical figures, but it's also about people's lives, how they interact with each other. And capitalism tames our most base instincts and allows us to peacefully cooperate with one another on the free market.
Well, Jose, you've done so much good work in this area. You're a real gem in the movement. We need people like you to tell the truth about what's going on in Venezuela. And you were with me at Mises University. There was those two guys, I forget their names, but I'm going to link to the video where they talk about socialism in Venezuela. And you've also been on Tom Wood's show multiple times. You've put out a ton of articles. So I'm going to link to all that. Is there anything else you can add? One question I wanted to ask you, do you still have family back in Venezuela that can relate some of these stories to you?
I have a few distant relatives there. My family had the good fortune of having a Colombian passport because my mom is Colombian. Mm-hmm. So she was able to use her Colombian dual citizenship to get a lot of our family out. Most of them live now in Colombia, United States, Spain, Panama, and a lot of other countries. Like, millions of Venezuelans have left. There's about like a 3 million person population of Venezuelan expatriates these days, and it's going to continue to grow.
And that's the amount of people that could get out. I mean, a lot of people were just trapped, I imagine.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that also ties into the whole shortage thing, because even airline flights, people can't get tickets due to capital controls. There's just no dollars in the economy. So some airlines have had to like shut down flights, shut down their operations in the country. It's terrible on all fronts.
It's almost at the point where they're political prisoners. You know, it may very well get to the point where they're not allowed to leave. And, you know, they're pretty much kept from leaving. I mean, one thing Yuri Maltsev talks about in relation to Russia is that they would make claims such as, well, it's not central planning that failed. We just never had a good enough plan. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. And that's the thing. People feel like they need like Harvard educated planners or like experts for that. But even like those people couldn't even manage economy. The thing is, it's a fundamentally flawed economic system that rejects private property rights, rejects a pricing system, rejects the idea that people can build companies and stuff like that through spontaneous actions on the free market, not by bureaucratic or political whims. Unfortunately, a lot of people still don't get that. And Venezuela is paying the price for it. And a lot of the Western world is actually validating what Venezuela is doing by making excuses for it. If the Western world has any fault in Venezuela's misery, it's the fact that they're spreading stupid ideas like socialism and giving it even more legitimacy by the day.
Oh, the Harvard and Yale elites are absolutely to blame for a lot of these misconceptions. In fact, I'm always reminded of the beginning of the movie Scarface, where he's in that room and they're interrogating him. And they're deciding whether to let him into the country, or they eventually send him to Freedom Town. But I remember at one point he stands up and says, "What, are you a communist? You like telling people what to think and what to feel?" So not defending Tony Montana, I mean, but the point is that when you talk to people who actually lived under these regimes, they never seem to talk about things in a favorable light, that these usually white leftist privileged kids at these Yale and Harvard universities say.
Yeah, I mean, it's ivory tower stuff. And it's actually funny because socialism has never been a working class movement. If you read the book, That's Wall true. Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, it's by Anthony Sutton, a Stanford professor. He points out that the rise of socialist movements were financed by powerful financial elites. These were not just working class people. It was heavily legitimized and weaponized by financial elites because they knew socialism is a good mechanism of social control at the end of the day. It's great for like the pettiest of tyrants and those that love controlling and bossing people around to use to their advantage.
Oh yeah. I mean, Lenin actually hated the peasants. He thought of them as lower class people. And when he was running through the Bolshevik Revolution, he was only utilizing people that he felt were revolutionary socialists. I mean, you know, socialist countries only use the poor, desperate people as pawns, as political pawns. And once they get what they want, the people suffer.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I'm going to link to everything we talked about, Jose. This has been a great episode. Keep doing what you're doing. I think you write for Mises.org and Ammo.com. So maybe just to end on that note, just tell me about what you're doing right now.
Well, right now, I'm continuing my writing. I write every week. I usually have an article coming out or two coming out each week for Mises or Ammo.com.
That's great.
I have some projects in the works as well. Got a website coming out and an ebook too. People can follow me on Twitter in the meantime at Jose Al Nino. And yeah, I'm also on Facebook as Jose Alberto Nino. So you can follow me there. And if you have any questions,
we'll link to all that. Thank you so much for everything you're doing. I hope people really take this information to heart and denounce socialism. And that's what it's all about, because some people just don't even know what's going on right now. They're just living in their own world. And we need people like you to speak out. Thank you so much for coming on, Jose.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Stephen.
Well, that'll do it for today. If you like what you heard, donate to me at patreon.com/thepeaceandlibertypodcast. As always, for peace and liberty.